It's time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for July 17th, 2021. As the Tour de France winds down, the Olympics will be winding up, although it's starting to be difficult to see how these games are going to be what we usually love about a Summer Olympics. My only wish is that the athletes stay safe and well. On the show this week, we discuss a really important issue that affects a lot of people and apparently might affect those who exercise intensely even more than the general population. On July 12th, the Irish Times published an article titled "Athletes More Likely Than Non-Athletes to Have Irregular Heartbeats." It seemed counterintuitive at first, but 13 studies between the years of 1990 and 2020 that analyzed data from 70,478 participants concluded that, quote, "there is a threshold beyond which exposure to increasing levels of exercise is linked to heart issues, including atrial fibrillation," end quote. As I read the article, I thought back to my conversation with Leonard Zinn and his tribulations with AFib, as well as all the ads on TV, which I thought were overblown in an effort to sell more pharmaceuticals. So I decided to talk with Trudy Loban, the expert in the field. Trudy is the founder and chief executive officer of the Arrhythmia Alliance, and she has some sage advice to pass along to us about heart irregularities and how to not only detect them, but what to do about them. Trudy will be with me in the second half of the show. My first guest is not new to the Outspoken Cyclist. She is one of the bravest, most passionate, and ardent activists for women's rights, Shannon Galpin. Her message today should strike a chord in the very depths of your psyche as she offers us the unvarnished truth about what is happening to the women of Afghanistan, especially the women's cycling team. Back in 2012 and 2013, the team was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize and Shannon was named National Geographic's Adventurer of the Year. Now, Afghanistan is under siege and women especially are at risk, including the women's cycling team. Shannon, who currently lives in Scotland, returned to the U.S. on a personal matter, and I was able to catch up with her a couple of days ago. Hello, Shannon. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. It's been a really long time since we spoke. 5 years.
Oh my God. Really?
2016. Yes. Well, how are you?
I'm doing okay, thank you. And that makes me realize that if we talked in 2016, that was, I had brain injuries going on and all sorts of other stuff. So
right, you look fabulous. We're on Zoom, so people know.
Oh,
so
yes.
I don't do a lot of Zoom interviews, but I'm doing more and more. And I find that they add sort of a different dimension, even if we're just using the audio.
Fabulous. Well, you'll see it move around a little bit because I'm on my phone. So, you know, everybody will have to deal with my swaying.
It's really a good connection. It's nice. So let's catch up with some of the thing you're doing. I definitely want to talk about the women's Afghan cycling team. There's so much going on in Afghanistan and not necessarily good. So what has been going on the last 5 years for you? I know a lot of wonderful projects.
Yeah. I mean, wow. When I think about 5 years, I mean, the biggest project aside from continuing to support Afghanistan as they started to make a transition with their cycling is working with my daughter. So right after I would have spoken to you, we would have gone on a year and a half around the world project where we literally lived out of suitcases for a year and a half doing field research around wildlife conservation. It was all focused on her passion of activism, which is wildlife conservation and climate justice. So it was kind of this really great spot for me to be able to, one, work with my own daughter, which was amazing, and really mentor her on social justice and activism through the lens that I'm familiar with in terms of storytelling and engaging other audiences, to give a shit.
Well, what's interesting is climate justice is so up right in your face right now. So it's like, of course, you were ahead of your time, as usual. But it's so tell us a couple. I mean, I know some of the things. I followed you, but maybe my listeners don't. Some of the things that you and Devin did, what were some of those cool projects?
Well, I mean, one of the top is that we tracked black rhinos in Namibia on the Skeleton Coast. I mean, that was a dream come true for, for anyone, I think, but definitely for myself. And the idea was that we were looking at endangered species through the lens of local solutions and local initiatives, so that we could really debunk a lot of these, kind of older, and this applies to Afghanistan as well, older models of, white saviorism, and use storytelling as a way to show, what are the local solutions to the global problems we have. And man, that was probably a huge highlight. I know the story that Devin hates most, which is we were in Borneo and we had to spend days on the river tracking pygmy elephants and learning about the ecosystem of how it's changing because of deforestation and palm oil. But it's literally like man-eating crocodile infested river. And we're in these tiny, tiny little boats. And she has yet to forgive me for that. Like literally, she will tell you, my mother tried to kill me. That is a quote. So,
Well, if you don't eat them at birth, it's your prerogative anywhere along the line. Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Shannon Galpin. If you do not know about her work, we will tell you how to follow her. She was the National Geographic Adventurer of the Year. Her Afghan women's team, and I say it's hers because it was your dream, even though it came true and you sort of let it go, was actually, as I remember, nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. Isn't that correct?
It was.
Yeah,
it was.
So anyway, we're talking about some of the activism that she and her daughter did. You have some current projects that look really interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the biggest one that I'm really focused on right now is, aside from we're creating a documentary out of that original project with my daughter. We had film crews with us for a lot of the time. Devin did all the interviews, and so now it's time to create, to kind of do that next step and create something out of that. So, trying to just do what every individual filmmaker does, which is find the funding, but then create this film around youth activism and extinction and climate justice. But then, my focus on cycling while 2016, because I'd had my second brain injury, I had to step back from, immediately. And I have not mountain biked since that.
You have not been on a mountain bike since?
No.
Oh, and you were so brave in Afghanistan. You flaunted that mountain biking in front of all those guys.
And I miss the rock gardens of Moab and my own backyard trails in Colorado. I was so lucky to live for 17 years up in the mountains. And I'm hoping that that's something that I can come back to literally this year. It's been 5 years this year. So there's some risks I'm willing to take more and more again. And biking is just not, it's just, that's too painful to let go.
I understand.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So the documentary is up. What else? There's something on your website that really intrigued me about Nine.
Oh, all the street art stuff. Well, so yeah, I mean, a big part of what I stepped into, because I lost a lot of language, brain injuries. I couldn't write anymore. I lost all my foreign languages, struggled even with, I mean, a lot of people don't realize really how much cognitive function I lost and how hard I fought to get it back, because I looked fine and I could cover up a lot of it. So I started doing a lot more visual art which I hadn't been doing as much of for a long time because Afghanistan took up everything. But I started doing murals in Denver. My daughter and I were doing joint mural projects around extinction issues. I was doing mine around gender violence and women's rights. But I started really going more into the visuals because I didn't have the language skills in the same way. And I was very lucky to have opportunities to do pop-up work that was just, you know, little takeovers of walls, and to also get commissions or work in festivals. And so a lot of my activism work just kind of fed a different direction, and I started using street art and installation work.
And you can see a lot of it on her website, which is shannongalpin.com. So we'll get there. So I want to talk about what's going on in Afghanistan. Of course, the U.S. is pulling all troops out. All hell is breaking loose over there. And there's a lot of concern about what the Taliban will do to the women of Afghanistan who are remaining. What's going on with the girls of the women of the cycling team?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I'll preface that first with just women and girls, which is because so far the women and girls on the cycling teams, you know, have been okay. But the situation for all women and girls is devastating. It's not what will the Taliban do. Over the last 2 weeks, we've already seen what the Taliban are going to do. They're taking over provinces and district centers they never have before. And they, you know, any illusion that they would be different, particularly towards women's rights, is clearly, you know, a fallacy. They are already making sure that women cannot work outside the home. They are forbidding, they're marrying off young women and girls to Taliban commanders. Everything that they were before is still what they have proved to be illustrating that, you know, the future will be. And a good friend of mine, Heather Barr, who's with Human Rights Watch, she has a great quote that in fact, I'm going to read it verbatim because I actually wrote it down. I don't want to mess up her words if they're not exactly mine. But it was, every feminist on the planet should be watching what's happening to women in Afghanistan right now. That the international community can so easily walk away and let this happen with a shrug speaks to how little equality any of us have. And
wow,
I would
words.
Like to see that on billboard, you know, in every, yeah. Because we said we were there for women and girls, whether that was true or not, doesn't matter. Now we are abandoning them to the same, you know, we're knowingly abandoning them. And for me, where my frustration gets is you have women and girls on the cycling team who are the first generation, you know, in the history of Afghanistan to be cyclists, to use bikes as a message that they deserve equality of movement, they deserve equality in sports, that they deserve to have the same freedoms as their male counterparts. And we saw, you know, these baby steps happening when I was first working with the team back in 2012 and 2013, evolve from a handful of girls in the country to last year during COVID, they had expanded to 7 different teams in 7 different provinces, racing across the country, women's racing in Afghanistan. There was 5 races last year. There's 7 planned for this year. There's mountain biking, there's BMX competitions, and then the 7 road cycling teams. So we've seen that they are capable of making this change, you know, without any international support. They haven't had international support other than what we had, you know, back in 2013, with Live and Giant, and, you know, a handful of donors and other things. Since then, they have not had international support, and yet the growth, along with their risks, has just increased.
So I have so many questions. I mean, and a lot of them are not maybe answerable at this point in time. So what is the age range of the girls and women who are currently, let's put it into the context of the teams? Because BMX, would look at younger audience.
Yeah, it's kind of the same. It's kind of that same group. It's always been kind of, you know, late middle school, high school, you know, up into early 20s. You know, and early 20s being that kind of cutoff point where we see girls either, you know, leaving the teams for college, for marriage, for jobs, you know, where they can't do both. And right now we have a refugee exodus as well. You know, one of the happy, sad stories to me is, you know, it's such a win, but it's also devastating, is that one of the girls that I first met, she was on the very first kind of generation of the cycling team back in 2013. She was just learning to ride a bike when I met her. Like she couldn't ride it in a fully straight line. You know, the bikes before we had our bike donation were so old that, you know, shifting was not happening. She was almost stopping her bike with her feet, Fred Flintstone style. And I was just petrified that she was going to hurt herself or hurt others. Right. And she's now representing cycling as the first Afghan to ever cycle in the Olympics with the Olympic refugee team this year.
Wow.
The fact that we have a young woman that is going to be in the Olympics is huge for cycling when it is such a controversial sport in Afghanistan and throughout the region. That she's on the refugee team is, to me, exciting and sad, right? Because you want all of these athletes on the Olympic refugee teams to be able to represent their own country.
Of course.
And there's a reason that, you know, that this team was founded. But I'm so excited for what she can show to the rest of Afghanistan in terms of what is possible. That, you know, the reason that she's able to make the team, that comes down to the enormous help that she's had in France. You know, when her and her family got asylum, to race, to get training. You know, that wouldn't have been possible inside of Afghanistan.
Well, and that brings me to some of the other more pertinent questions of the moment, the pressing questions of the moment. And that is, what kind of help can be found for the team and for the women? And I mean, you hate to see them all leave the country to ride their bikes. And yet, I'm not really, maybe I don't understand everything that's going on over there, but I'm not seeing much of an alternative at this point if they're going to be hunted down. And not in the sense of, you know, maybe a gun held to their head, but I, you know, that's kind of what my vision is. That's what I'm seeing.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking. I've had multiple women, reach out asking for help, how to leave, how to get asylum. And yet we see the same thing is happening in Great Britain and in the US, where, you know, there's already a lack of support in immigration. It's already, you know, becoming polarized, and you're seeing that they're being called to task to make sure that they at least get the translators out. You know, the people that support international forces, you know, will be targeted, and they have earned, you know, all of our gratitude and support, and they need to be taken care of now. And so then you have that huge amount of backlog of applications for asylum. And there's many human rights groups that are saying, you know, okay, but what about these women? You know, what about all these women that grew up post-Taliban, that we told them, you can do anything. You are the future of your country. And they did that. So they are now going to be targeted for doing exactly the things that were put in place to, you know, to encourage their education. You know, they became members of parliament. They are judges and lawyers and members of the military and police forces. And not to mention, you know, activists, artists, musicians, singers, and sports athletes that are all targeted because that is not accepted under the Taliban. You know, we have an obligation. We have literally a moral obligation to support these young women, whether that is, you know, making sure we increase asylum and immigration, or whether that's making sure that we making sure that we support the women who will be staying. You know, you also don't want a mass exodus if that was at all possible. But right now, we seem to just be abandoning the country, and that comes with a moral obligation.
What a conundrum, huh?
Yeah. It's never has never been easy, you know, for these young women and girls.
And it isn't simple.
No.
We're going to take a short break. We didn't originally have one scheduled for our conversation, but it's pretty heavy, and I think we could all use a moment just to reflect on what Shannon's saying. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Well, that was a nice interlude, and we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks, and we are talking with Shannon Galpin about the Afghan women's cycling team and about women's rights in general. So what do you see as a future, and I hate to say just for the cycling team, because of course it's everything, but for this, I mean, you have a woman now who will be, even though she's on the refugee team, can she wear her country's colors on the team?
She can. From my understanding, and I'm not, I should have looked into that before, is that she can on her jersey put on, that. Because I think everyone is linked, through their storytelling and through, and the Olympic refugee team is really wanting to highlight where everyone comes from so that we can have a better understanding of why do we have refugees, and that why do we need to be continuing to support refugees, and these young athletes become advocates, not just for their country, but also for refugees on a global scale.
Well, it's very scary.
It is.
On a lot of levels.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I think that's why I really love that quote that Heather Barr tweeted out about, that, if we turn away, that this speaks to, it's not just about Afghan women. It's about how little equality we have achieved as women. If we are willing to just walk away and allow them, whatever their fate is. Well, that speaks then to how little we value any woman. And that, and that's my work. That's my passion, is, looking at how are we changing equality? How are we combating gender violence? Afghanistan just happened to be, one place in which I was working that I fell in love with, and I fell in love with the people, and there were opportunities to be of use. And now I'm an advisor to the current Afghan Cycling Federation. So I'm an advisor for them. I'm still involved with them. And, they are racing. They're racing, they're training, they're wanting to expand. I mean, to me, the issue is we cannot allow the cycling community to walk away. We cannot allow women's rights groups to walk away, or our government to walk away. Like, there needs to be more funding to support, because there's ways in which this could continue. BMX and track cycling are not as public. They're in contained training grounds. And so if we can get the investment for track cycling, that's an Olympic sport. All of these young women and men who will be targeted for road cycling in certain provinces, in certain areas, or who are just scared to take the risk, track cycling is an alternative. The BMX team is already existing and could recruit more people if they had proper BMX facilities. And it's also an Olympic sport.
Yeah, and BMX facilities are not as expensive to build. I mean, tracks aren't cheap, but you can do it. But certainly BMX is not a difficult sport to produce in terms of a course, a BMX course.
Exactly.
Wow. So I guess the last question, or one of the last questions I have, is what do you think we can do as sort of lay people, people who listen to the show, people who watch the news, people who, we're seeing it from thousands and thousands of miles away. And even though it rips our hearts out, you feel kind of helpless.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering,
Definitely.
You seem to find a way to stay involved, but I'm not sure for people who have never gotten into that kind of activism, I mean, yes, Black Lives Matter changed the way we think about activism in this country, but we need, I think that it's a much more expansive thing that we're talking about here.
Yeah, I think it's rooted in that same place of not turning away, of facing, particularly as white people, facing how are we complicit? And all Americans are complicit in Afghanistan and its future by the nature of we've been involved as a country politically and militarily for four decades. We need to look at how do we tap into our compassion and our empathy so that even though, particularly with Afghanistan, we're tired. You know, the American public is tired of the narrative of Afghanistan. Tough. You know, tough. Like, you know, it's like, okay, so that's where we have to dig deep and say, okay, but what if that was my family? What if this was my country? You know, that other countries had been meddling in, or that we had proxy wars, or that we had a civil war. So many different ways in which we need to remember our common links of humanity. And I think with how do we help, it's very much like being sensitive to how I think we saw a lot of people step into the Black Lives Matter movement of what is my role? And the most important thing is I need to be educated. I need to be learning. I need to be having a voice. Like, this is not the time to be quiet. So we need to be sharing stories of Afghanistan. We cannot let this just reside within the spheres of nonprofits or human rights organizations or those of us who have been involved there. This should be a global outcry that we support these young women and girls. And you know, there are very direct ways. I mean, this then has to happen beyond just saying, oh, I wish this wasn't happening, or sharing stories. Then it's money. And I am so far beyond the point where you say, okay, well, you know, advocacy is enough. No, action happens because we financially support it. And people have not stepped up to support a cycling team that they themselves were National Geographic Adventurers of the Year in 2015. They were nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. No other cycling team has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. You know, they had exhibitions in museums, and yet no funding beyond the initial support back in 2013 and 2014, which really came from one bike company and a couple of smaller, you know, cycling related organizations like Scratch Labs, or who else is Osprey. You know, we need financial incentive to allow these young women to continue to ride, to allow, and this always comes back to, it's sport. You know, is that the priority? Yes, it is. You know, these young women are changing the face of Afghan equality onto wheels because the sport of cycling is normalizing women on bikes. And women on bikes means equality of movement and freedom of movement and access and opportunity. So cycling becomes access to human rights more than any other sport.
What a great place to end it, huh? Well, so I'm, yeah. It isn't. So if people want to support it, is there a foundation?
There is not. There are two ways to support. Since I closed my nonprofit when I got my brain injuries, there are two ways to support. There's a GoFundMe that was set up by the Afghan Federation for the team. And this is an amazing way to support. It's to be able to provide equipment and to cover you kind of the basics that they can take care of themselves in country. So that's one way. You can follow me on Patreon. I have a lot of public posts that do not have a barrier, that I have been writing more and more about the cycling team lately, mainly because you've got multiple ways to support, you know, in terms of the team, but you're looking at it from a human rights aspect, looking at it from a sports aspect. And anyone can reach out to me directly if they are able to support, because I can link it through the Afghan Sports Trust in the UK, which was set up by two dear friends who worked with the Ski Foundation and others in Afghanistan. So we can accept funds and redirect funds through the Afghan Sports Trust, and we can do the GoFundMe. And honestly, if the cycling industry would step up, we can do a world of good again. But 6 years ago is when they got bikes. That those bikes do not function anymore. They need solid equipment. They need resources. We need big infrastructure support in terms of, could we get a track built? There is land that the Olympic Federation will donate for that. Yeah, I mean, there are ways, and people can reach out to me, but we don't need clothing donations. Let me stress that right now.
No more kits.
No more kits. I had boxes. I literally had to keep a storage unit and spend thousands of dollars to keep a storage unit open just to store the donated kit. We don't need donated kit. We need financial support.
Well, we have a problem right now with equipment. Just globally,
yeah,
we have a problem.
That's true.
I'm not sure. So there's, I don't know, maybe the Pros Closet, who just had a ton of funding, millions of dollars of funding.
Really?
Yes, they were just funded. And I don't know why, perhaps, tapping into the Pros Closet might be a way to say, listen, you have all these used bikes, and take a percentage and do something good.
Exactly.
There are a lot of organizations like that. I can certainly see options and possibilities, but I guess the most important thing is keeping these girls safe.
Exactly. And what I don't want to have happen is the girls who are not able to leave, that then we're like, we have to accept that these other girls that are staying behind, these young women and girls, because you have a country of Afghans that do not deserve to be abandoned inside the country. They deserve to still have opportunities if they are asking for it, regardless of how we perceive their risk. If they are asking to be able to ride bikes or to compete in sports or to be street artists or activists or go to school, we need to make sure that we are supporting that, because it isn't just about about asylum and refugee. It's also about how do we make sure that all of those that will be living in Afghanistan are able to do what they choose to do, and that we support that.
Wonderful. Well, as always, just such a wonderful conversation, even though it's really, it rips your heart out to talk about it.
It does.
Well,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it does.
We've been talking with Shannon Galpin, and it's just been a wonderful conversation. Shannon, give people a way to reach you. Is it shannongalpin.com?
Yeah. ShannonGalpin.com. You can email me through there. You can see what my other work is. The link to Patreon is there. My Instagram has a lot of the links as well. In my bio, I keep a lot of the links there, in terms of the Afghan national team's GoFundMe and others. So that's SGalpin74. Those are probably the two best ways.
Okay. Well, I know you're going to be heading back to Scotland soon.
Yes.
And
yes.
Say hello to your daughter, who is remarkable unto herself, but then look at her mother. And thank you so much for finding time to talk with me. It's been a really rough year, I know, for all of us.
Yeah, it has. And maybe that's a lesson that we need to all be connecting more. I still can't believe it's been that long since we talked last, but I'm grateful to have the opportunity to connect with you and to see you.
There we are with our long hair.
I know, exactly.
Well, have a wonderful day. We will talk again, and maybe we won't wait 5 years. How's that?
That would be amazing. Yes.
All righty.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
If you are interested in Shannon's work, you can log on to shannongalpin.com. And log on to OutspokenCyclist.com for this episode for more links and information about Shannon and the Afghan Women's Cycling Organization. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll speak with Trudy Loban from the Arrhythmia Alliance. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
The Outspoken Cyclist is proud to have Bike Law as a trusted partner. If you find yourself in need of legal advice or assistance as it pertains to any cycling issue, log on to bikelaw.com. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. Just a quick note before I introduce our next guest. When we spoke with East Coast Greenway's Executive Director, Dennis Mercado Soriano, a few weeks ago, we talked about the first ever New York City to Philadelphia bike ride to raise funds for trail development and to put some new East Coast Greenway leaders in the New York City corridor. The leadership positions have been filled and over $180,000 has been raised so far as people sign on for the inaugural ride. There are still a few open spots if you're interested, but registration will officially close on August 8th. Log on to greenway.org for more information. We've all probably seen the innumerable ads that warn us about AFib, atrial fibrillation, an irregularity of the heart rhythm that can cause blood clots, strokes, and death. And while there have been some breakthroughs in drugs in the past 10 years to help prevent the blood clots, AFib seems to be affecting more of the population than we might think. Trudy Loban is the executive director of the Arrhythmia Alliance, and she's got some helpful ways of not only recognizing whether you have a problem, but what to do about it. Hello, Trudy. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today. It's nice to see you.
And see you too. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. We're going to be talking about a really important topic. And I think that most people think that this is something that happens to only older people. And many of my listeners are really heavy endurance athletes. So I think this will, certainly wake them up a little bit, I hope. So tell us a little bit about you. You are the founder and chief executive officer of the Arrhythmia Alliance. And, you know, arrhythmia, everybody kind of gets scared and there's all these ads on TV for AFib drugs. So tell us a little bit about you and your work.
So as you said, I'm Trudy Loban. You can tell by my accent, I'm British with my heart in the US. And I founded the Arrhythmia Alliance over 20 years ago. The Arrhythmia Alliance is heart rhythm disorders. And the most common heart rhythm disorder is atrial fibrillation, AF or AFib as it's known. And people think it's an older person's condition, but more and more younger people are also being detected as having an irregular heart rhythm, which turns out to be AF. For some, there are no symptoms, so they're called asymptomatic. And for others, you feel the palpitations, the pounding. It's like a bag of worms in your chest or a banging of the drums. And importantly, it's when the heart's not beating in rhythm, and in AF, it's where the chambers of the heart are quivering. And so if it's quivering, the heart isn't flowing freely. And so little clots can form. And if one of those clots breaks off, it can cause heart failure, or most commonly, it travels to the brain and causes an AF-related stroke. And AF-related strokes are more devastating, debilitating, often prove to be more fatal than any other type of stroke. And yet, if we're diagnosed, we receive anticoagulation therapy and treatment for the irregular rhythm, we can be active, we can get on with our lives. So it's important to know if we have an irregular heart rhythm.
Well, I know you have a know your pulse sort of thing that you can do each day. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. And I thought that was really interesting. I watched your video and I thought that that was something that everybody should probably know about. So I guess I'd like to know if there's a gender difference between who might end up with AF, more men, more women, or is it fairly an equal opportunity, disease, if you want to call it that?
So white men have the highest lifetime risk of developing AF compared to black men or white or black women. However, among older age groups, the incidence of AF is higher among women. potentially because increased age is a risk factor of AF, and you know, women tend to live longer than men.
Interesting. And yet this can occur in young people.
It can. And it can occur in apparently healthy, fit people.
Yes, and we are going to talk about that. So is this something that everybody should be on the lookout for? I mean, is this something that, is there any precursor to it? Like, is there a genetic bent to it, or?
It can affect anyone at any time. Although, you know, age is a major risk factor, with about 10% of people aged 65 or older having AF, but it can develop at any age, and therefore everyone should be aware of AF and get into the habit of regularly checking your pulse. You mentioned earlier, Know Your Pulse, our Know Your Pulse to Know Your Heart Rhythm, It Could Save Your Life campaign. Go to knowyourpulse.org, watch the video that you mentioned. We weigh ourselves, we're aware of our cholesterol, we're aware of what we should eat, we shouldn't smoke, we shouldn't drink too much. We don't need any equipment, it's not like it's blood pressure monitors. All we need is three fingers of one hand onto our wrist of the other hand. Or nowadays there are apps and there are digital devices to give us our own EKGs. But the most important thing, get to know the rhythm of your heart by knowing your pulse. Is it regular? Is it irregular? Is it fast? Is it slow? And that's how you can end up detecting AF and talking to your doctor.
So not everybody's heart rhythm is the same. So yours may be different from, is there something called normal, or and then there are deviations from that?
We talk about heart rate, and a lot, obviously athletes know their heart rate. A typical heart rate is between 60 and 100 beats per minute. The lower your heart rate, the healthier you're going to be. However, you may have a heart rate of 61. Fantastic. But is it regular? During that minute that you're measuring your heart rate, does it race? Does it then go slow? Does it then become erratic? So your overall reading for your heart rate is 61. But there may be times when it's up at 90 or down in the low 50s or something. So heart rate normally between 60 and 100 beats per minute. But is it in rhythm? We are talking about the rhythm. Is there a steady rhythm? Yes, it may get faster if you're running. It may get slower when you're sitting watching TV. But is it regular? And that's the important thing.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with Trudy Loban. She is the founder and chief executive officer of the Arrhythmia Alliance. She's in the UK, stuck. Can't come back to South Carolina right now, as many of us are not traveling. Some of us are. And we're talking about atrial fibrillation, which is AF. We're just going to keep using that term. I wanted to ask a question about, are there any other causes of an irregular heartbeat besides AF?
There are lots of different arrhythmias, lots of different heart rhythm disorders. Some are genetic. We know that there are studies out recently that alcohol can, you know, too much alcohol can bring on AF. You know, there are lots of lifestyle risks, but for some, it just happens. So, you know, there are numerous arrhythmias. AF is the most common form of an arrhythmia.
We're going to take a real short break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about a study that showed that athletes might be more prone to AF than the general public. And we're also going to talk about how to do this Know Your Pulse thing. We're going to demonstrate it a little bit here, or talk about it a little bit more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. If you're just joining me, we're speaking with Trudy Loban. She is the founder and chief executive officer of the Arrhythmia Alliance. And if you've been watching TV and get really sick of them, there are ads for AF medications like every 5 seconds. If it's not car sales, it's drug sales. So what has science done to look at AF and be able to even out an irregular heartbeat?
Well, For 60 years, the only anticoagulant, the only drug that was available to help prevent clots forming caused by AF was warfarin, Coumadin. But in the last 10 years, there have been at least four other new anticoagulants with fewer side effects than warfarin. So that's why you're seeing a lot of advertisements. Those do not treat AF, but they are vitally important because they help prevent clots forming. If there are no clots, they can't break away. They can't travel to your brain to cause an AF-related stroke. Then there are various drugs or surgical treatments to put the heart back in rhythm. So for some, antiarrhythmic drugs sort their AF out. For others, a shock to the heart, cardioversion, can sort it. For others, ablation, where they either freeze or they burn the tiny little bit of the heart that's quivering, that's causing the atrial fibrillation. And that can prevent it as well. So again, it's all about talking with your physician, deciding what is the best option for you and how AF impacts on you. Most importantly is making sure that you are anticoagulated, because if you're not and you've got AF, you have a 500% chance increased risk of a stroke, and AF-related strokes are often fatal. So you need to make sure, check the rhythm of your heart, find out if you've got AFib. If you have, talk to your doctor about anticoagulation. Go to our website, heartrhythmalliance.org. All the information is there. You can download to read. You can watch videos from medical experts. Talk to your own doctor. Find out what's best for you. Once you've got anticoagulation medication or therapy, say it doesn't treat the AF, so your symptoms won't go away, but also then talk to your doctor about what treatment options are available that will best suit you.
This article I saw in the Irish Times, there were a series of apparently 13 studies over a 20-year period, thousands of people, 70,000 plus people, saying that these endurance athletes, these heavily, allegedly healthy athletes, were more prone to AF. Do you have any idea of why that might be? Actually, you were quoted in that article. Any idea why that might be the case?
Well, it's thought, these are people that are professional athletes, excessive exercise. And they're basing on what is known at present, and there's still research going on, that the likelihood is the amount and the intensity of exercise that the athletes do that increase their risk of AF, rather than the exercise itself. We all know vitally important that we exercise daily, we keep active, especially during the pandemic and all the things that are closed or whatever, but it is the amount and the intensity. Too much of anything isn't too good for you. And it's the same with exercise. And these studies are showing too much exercise and too intense. There's a big difference between jogging around the park each day and regularly competing in marathons. A jog around the park, you can't compare it to a marathon. But there are more research is needed to determine the exact level and the intensity of exercise that would put you at risk, and to determine which athletes would be most at risk. So, there's a red flag, don't over-exercise, don't be too intense, but there's a lot more research needs to be done to identify which group of athletes are likely to be affected. The reason why young athletes under 55 years seem to be particularly at risk of AF may be, it may relate that to the fact that the risk of AF increases with age. So essentially, because of their age, the older non-athletes were more likely to have AF than the younger non-athletes, possibly making the difference in AF incidence between older athletes and older non-athletes smaller than the one between younger athletes and younger non-athletes. Again, more research is needed.
Is there any correlation between, now you mentioned alcohol, but between food, your diet, and AF? Has anybody looked at that?
Well, again, we want, if we drink too much coffee, it can cause palpitations. Too much of anything, excess of anything, And, you know, a glass of wine is absolutely fine. A bottle of wine isn't, you know? And the same with certain foods. It's about, and this is relating to so many diseases these days, it's about moderation. It's about healthy eating. It's about healthy lifestyle. And if not, we're going to see an increase in cancer. We're going to see an increase in heart rhythm disorders, cardiovascular disease, and therefore we're going to see a lot more people with AF and sadly a lot more people dying from AF-related strokes or heart failure caused by AF. And AF also causes anxiety and depression, vascular dementia. So, you know, those simple palpitations, if they're not simple palpitations, if they are AF, take it seriously. Talk to your physician. Do something about it.
Scary stuff. However, if you pay attention, apparently you can ward off some of these things. So let's talk another moment about know your pulse and what people should do. Just to reiterate it, should you do it when you wake up, during the day, before you go to sleep?
Don't do it when you first wake up or as you're drifting off to sleep, but don't do it when you've just been running around that park. You need to sit down for 5 minutes. Don't have a coffee or an alcoholic drink. Just sit down quietly for 5 minutes so you're doing your resting heart rate, your resting rhythm. Obviously, if you've been racing around, it's going to be a faster rhythm. So just sit down quietly for 5 minutes. If you take three fingers from one hand and put it on the inside of your wrist, the way you can feel the sort of sinewy part. Get to know where you can feel your pulse. There are other places in the body, in your neck, in your groin, that you can feel your pulse, but most people relate to their wrist. I'm doing it now as we're speaking. I can feel my pulse. All you have to do is count to 30 and multiply it by 2, and that gives you your heart rate. But what we're doing here is seeing whether there is a steady, or is it or longer? You know, we want to know if it's in rhythm. The more you do it, the more you will get used to your heart rhythm. Some people have a naturally faster rhythm or a slower rhythm. You know, just like some of us have higher blood pressure, some people live with low blood pressure. Get to know the rhythm of your heart. But if it's erratic, if it's all over the place, talk to your doctor. Make sure you don't have an underlying, potentially fatal arrhythmia, and don't let that be AF. But if it is, it can be treated. And one of the things I've been doing here in the UK, we've been rolling out Know Your Pulse events at the COVID-19 centres when they're getting the vaccines. You know, a lot of people have to sit after they've had their vaccine or while they're standing in line waiting for their vaccine. We've been teaching how to take their pulse. Or if you go to our website, knowyourpulse.org, you can watch a video. You can also see about these apps. There are watches, there are downloadable apps. There's even a free EKG you can download for 24 hours that will do your ECG for you. Some of them will even tell you if you have possible AF. You still need to speak to your doctor. At the end of the day, you need to engage with your doctor, but you can help yourself to help your doctor, because for some people, they can be in permanent AF. For some people, AF can come and go. It's called paroxysmal AF. So you might feel it, but when you go to your doctor, it might be okay. And then you make another appointment and it's okay. Whereas if you keep a record of your manual pulse rhythm, or you have one of these devices, and some of them are very expensive and some of them are very inexpensive, they will take a one lead EKG and you can show that to your healthcare professional. And that will help them, as well as doing their own tests or feeling your pulse, to detect, diagnose AF. And we say, detect AF with simple pulse check, protect against AF with anticoagulation therapy to avoid an AF-related stroke, correct AF with access to appropriate treatment. And if you detect, protect, correct, you will perfect the patient outcome, restoring the patient back to a person. So it's really simple.
It sounds really simple. It's not like you have to, like diabetics have to actually draw blood.
This is not at all.
So simple. We've been speaking with Trudy Loban. She is the founder and chief executive officer of the Arrhythmia Alliance. She's in the UK, but her heart's here in South Carolina, apparently. KnowYourPulse.org. Trudy, thank you so much for talking to me. I think this is really an important issue. I'm really glad I got a chance to talk with you this week, and I hope you get to come back soon.
Thank you. I would love to. Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a great day.
And you too.
Trudy Loban is the executive director of the Arrhythmia Alliance. If you would like to watch the video and learn the proper way to take your pulse, you can log on to knowyourpulse.org. And for comprehensive information about all types of heart irregularities, go to arrhythmiaalliance.org. My thanks to Trudy and Shannon for joining me this week. What an interesting show, if I do say so myself. My thanks to you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the conversations as much as I did. Check out our Facebook page for many links, photos, and conversations all week long. We post each episode of the show to Instagram, and you can always find a complete synopsis of each episode, along with links, at OutspokenCyclist.com. If you don't already, please subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and take a moment to leave a comment or post a review. Liking the show is a good thing, too. I'm working on several interesting stories right now, so be sure to tune in next week. And in the meantime, stay safe, stay well, and remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.